We began this course now quite a few years ago when we realized that more and more students were coming, taking languages from us, or having at best maybe 1 year of biblical language. And if you know anything about language study, you realize that when you actually learn the language is when you start reading texts. And it's really that what we used to call the intermediate second or sometimes even a third year of the language is when you finally get beyond pounding the paradigms. And do I have them all now, more or less? And can start reading. And what it does is it reinforces the grammar as at the same time that you start having fun. Because this is the payoff. You actually get to read. It's not just reading text. It's actually reading God's Word. This is a good thing. This is what we do. And in some ways, reading it in the original is what separates, I hate to put it in these terms, but to sort of separate the pros from the amateurs. Part of being a pastor is learning to be a theologian. If anyone says to you, I'm just a pastor, I'm not a theologian, they haven't thought about this enough, because they are theologians. You can't be a theologian without being a pastoral theologian either. Somebody says, I'm a theologian, not a pastor. They don't have this put together right. You can't study theology without its application to the real lives of real people. And that has to do with pastoral ministry. But for a church heritage and tradition that takes sola scriptura as seriously and as strongly as we do as Lutherans, and one of the benchmarks of our ministerium and one of the hallmarks of this seminary is that we take seriously the study of the Word of God in the actual languages in which it was revealed. When people ask you, Pastor, what's the best English translation, what's the answer? Well, yeah, some are good, better than others. Some are better for certain purposes than others. I mean, the question is, what are you looking for? See, you want to get the big picture? Is this your first time somebody's opened the Bible? Do you want to do some intensive Bible study? Do you want a translation that replicates the original even more literalistically, even if it's not a good... I mean, there's all sorts of questions there. But ultimately, the question is, they're all translations are, by definition, translations. And the fact that our church has never sort of put its imprimatur on any one translation, by default, we do this when we have like a new hymnal coming out. Well, because someone has to decide, let's try the ESV now. Well, which is what they're using for the new hymnal. And then CBH wants to have a standard one to redo catechetical material, so we are all sort of saying the Bible passages the same way in confirmation class, which is not a bad idea, okay? I think we all know that we sort of got schnookered into the NIV in the previous incarnation of a hymnal, for better or for worse, because it was cheap. They got the copyright cheap. We've endured a half a generation of NIV with its attendant blessings and curses, including an evangelical model of translating sovereign Lord, which just makes me jerk for all those Yahweh Adonais or Adonai Yahwehs in the Old Testament. But the point is, a translation is translation, and our ministerium is able to work with translations. Look, let's face it, there's lots of pastors out there who aren't working with Greek and Hebrew on a regular basis. It'll never happen to any of you, I know that. But look, once you've seen the world in color, why go back to black and white, you know? Once you've been to the top of the mountaintop, you may come down to the plain, but you never forget what it looks like from the mountaintop. And if a pastor says, I'm not using the Greek and Hebrew, at least they have to admit that they're missing something. And you can use an English translation and still do adequate work. I'm not saying that you can't preach the Word of God from an English translation, but it's still a translation. And our ministerium understands that and learns the exegetical tools by which we can and are able to go back and actually do some work on the original. right? That's why we invest. For all you invest as seminarians and all we invest as church in the biblical languages, there better be a good reason for this, and it's not just to jump through some hoop and say, oh yeah, I had Hebrew at the seminary, you know, those ivory tower people, you know. But it's kind of, you can open up Genesis 1 for your confirmands and show them that the Bible was written in Hebrew. It's got to be a little bit more than that. And we do take this seriously. It kind of goes to the question, if we're going to preach on the Word of God, we have to preach on the text. And if you're going to preach on a text, you got to ask, what does the text mean? And my rule of thumb for hermeneutics is that the text means what the text meant, which immediately puts us into the world of historical exegesis. Before your Bible study can say, what does it mean to me? You have to ask the question, what does it mean? And to ask the question, what does it mean, ask the historical question, what did it mean when Matthew wrote it, or Jesus said it, or Isaiah preached it, or Moses wrote it down? And that's historical exegesis that enters into the world of the people in that time and place, and they didn't speak English then. They didn't even speak German then. They were working with other languages and other times and places, and this is what it means to take our exegetical homework seriously as pastoral theologians. That's what seminary is all about. So I hope with a little bit of that in the background, that's why we're doing this. And we've picked some texts in this course that not only will practice the art of translation by applying fundamental skills in Hebrew to basic interpretation of biblical texts, but we'll also lay the foundation. We've picked some texts that we start with easy ones like Deuteronomy. Just look at the text on the next page, and these are a little bit subject to change. This schedule is, like all schedules, advisory only. But have you done, how many of you did Deuteronomy 5 in your Hebrew class? Okay, see, most of you in the fall here are coming from an undergraduate program. The reason we start with Deuteronomy 6 is that when I used to teach elementary Hebrew, which I don't do much anymore, we always read Deuteronomy 5, which is a fun chapter because, what's in Deuteronomy 5? It's a Decalogue, it's 10 Commandments. All right, and it's not quite the same as in Exodus 20. And immediately you're into some of those kinds of questions, and you got texts, you all have a Bible. Look at Deuteronomy 5. Let's look at Deuteronomy 5. Do I have a Bible? I don't have it on the screen because I only got Deuteronomy 6 on the screen. I got to find my little paperback. I'm lugging around this. You probably don't remember when BHS was... when I went to school way back in the olden days, we didn't have BHS. We had BHK3, Bibliobreca Kittle. And they were coming out with BHS. It's really the same text. It's just cleaner and neater, and they put more of the Dead Sea Scroll stuffs in the critical apparatus. But these were coming out in fascicles, you know, those little pieces. So every book was its own little thing. And I remember in graduate school, I had a guy, he carried around the whole Old Testament as a briefcase because he had, like, you know, 30 of these little fascicles. That was an unrelated, stupid story to tell, I guess. So I got the big book here because I've lost. They painted our office this summer, somewhere back in June, and they took all my books out and then put them all back in, most of them right side up, but not in the same order. And I can't find anything. Well, let's pick this up in verse 5:1. Let me make a couple of comments. Just some observations, since you didn't read Deuteronomy 5, and we're reading Deuteronomy 6, so we want to get a chance to Deuteronomy 5, and we got to fill up the hour. V'yikra Moshe el kol Yisrael v'yomer elohim. You can translate this, right? Sight unseen? Anyone? V'yikra Moshe? Moses cried out or proclaimed el kol Yisrael v'yomer elohim? And said to them, Shema Yisrael, Parshema, Imperative, right? Second person masculine singular imperative. Hear, O Israel, et ha-chukim ve-et ha-mishpatim asher anoki dover ba-oznekem hayom. What does he say? Hear, O Israel, eth tells you, direct object, ha-chukim. Do you know chukim? Statutes. It's from the noun kok, but it's chukim. We'll see this in chapter 6 as well. The statutes and the mishpats, which anoki dover, pars dover. Coattail form is your cow participle, remember? Which I am speaking. Which I am speaking, ba'oznekim, in your ears, your ozens, hayom. Idiom for today. Ulimatem otham, ushmartem lasotam. All right, parse ulimatem and talk about the syntax of this a little bit. Lamathem, this is actually a regular form, right? Katal, katala, katala, katal, katalti, katalu, kitaltem, kitalten, katal. You will, or you, lamath. Right? It's cow perfect, second plural masculine. Is it while consecutive? That's the point. And how do you know? Little review of grammar. While consecutive with the imperfect is always marked. Right? How can you tell while consecutive with an imperfect? Because it's got a pathak dagesh forte connected to the imperfect prefix. Right? See it a mile away. But while consecutive with the perfect is not marked unless the accent moves over. Do you know that old rule? We'll see that and we'll talk about it. So how do you know whether this is perfect while consecutive or just perfect? Answer? Well, context, all right? Rule of thumb, if it is, if it can be while consecutive, probably is. Right? And it is. If so, then, I'm making a syntactical point, just to point something out here. What's the relationship between this perfect while consecutive and whatever verb started the sequence, and what verb starts the sequence? So you're in a sequence now. You start with a verb, then you have perfect while, the converted forms are perfect while consecutive following the main verb. Do you understand this, by the way? I'll talk about this later when we review our verb tenses a little bit. But there really are three verb tenses in Hebrew. Most grammars do not explain this very well. All right? There are three tenses in Hebrew. Perfect, imperfect, and while consecutive. As an independent tense, working with the imperfect, which originally was a past tense. I shouldn't say which originally. There are two sets of forms that end up looking the same. The imperfects and the old preterite, which was a narrative past tense. When Hebrew lost its case endings at the end of the late Bronze Age, almost all Middle Eastern languages went through a significant language shift about 1200 BC. It's kind of interesting. Some theories of the conquest are connected to this archaeologically demonstrable event. Hebrew used to have case endings. So instead of yaktul, which became yaktol or yiktol, there was the old imperfect was actually yaktalu with an u at the end. All those long vowels at the end of both nouns and verbs fell off. So you ended up with a past tense, which was yaktul, and an imperfect, which was yaktalu, both looking like yaktul, which has become yiktol in your paradigms. Okay? So what you really have in the imperfect while consecutive is kind of a lost tense that the Masoretes knew about and marked in a distinctive way with the while consecutive pointed as it is, pathak dagesh forte. That's where this comes from. Okay. Now, the mystery in all of this is that explains everything except the perfect while consecutive. Where did this come from? And here's where even the best grammar books punt. All right, you can look this up in Waltke and O'Connor, and they don't know either. Okay. And if Waltke and O'Connor don't know, nobody don't know. Okay. They think that this just developed a little bit as an analogy to the imperfect while. See, when grammar books explain the imperfect while consecutive as changing an imperfect into a perfect, Or some grammar books even call it a while conversive because it converts a future to a past. That's just wrong. It's not changing the imperfect. It's marking an old past tense. Do you see the difference? That's what's really going on there. So anyway, that's just kind of a mini side excursus on the history of the Hebrew verb system. So when you get the perfect, you see, really isn't a future tense. The perfect is a wild card. The perfect while consecutive is a wild card. And it goes with whatever starts the sequence. This was all a way just to make that point. They're sort of the odd man out in these tenses. In which case, how should you translate this? What's the verb that sets the tone for this perfect? Shema, which is imperative. So what you have here is really not just another imperative, but here's the force of while consecutive. It's a subsequent imperative. If I tell you to open the door and close the window and don't care which order you do them in, I could use two imperatives. If I tell you to get up and come to the front of the room, I could use a while consecutive because first you get up and then I want you to do something. See? So do you see what you have here? He says, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes in the mishpats which I'm speaking to your ears today, and once you heard them, then learn them. And once you've heard them and learned them, and then shamar la'asotham, and then actually do them." See, pay attention to do them. Shamar la'asoth, infinitive construct. Lo eth avotheinu karath Yahweh eth habrith hazoth. You can translate this. Why is the word order inverted? Lo eth avotheinu. Oh, I skipped verse 2, didn't I? So I'm just so excited. Yahweh Eloheinu karath amanu. There's nothing exciting in verse 2. Yahweh our God made with us a covenant in Horeb. Lo eth avotheinu. Not, how do you know that eth is with here? Not with our fathers. Well, there's a verb, karat. Answer, first of all, it doesn't make sense. Does he say he didn't cut our fathers? See, fathers doesn't work as a direct object. Secondly, when you get to eth habarith, you got the direct object. That's what he karated. So, not with our fathers, but note the inverted word order because he's making the point, not with our fathers did Yahweh karath habarith hazoth. Key, now this is a great little line, all right? Can you diagram this sentence? Ki itanu, anachnu, ela fo, hayom, kulanu chayim. Not with our fathers, ki but, here ki means but, itanu, with us, anachnu, we, ela, these, fo, adverb, here, hayom, today, kulanu, all of us, chayim, alive. All right? I mean, isn't this, this is just vivid. You can't make this up. This is Moses pounding the pulpit. This will happen to you, right? You get so caught up, you kind of forget about getting a real sentence out. Not with our fathers did Yahweh make this covenant, but with us, we, these here today, all of us alive. There's no sentence there. But it doesn't matter, right? Because he's making the point, and he's making it very effectively. He's just excited. Panim b'panim d'bir Yahweh amakim. Face in face, Yahweh spoke with us from the mountain, from the midst of the fire. Well, not quite. Oh, I got to make one more comment on verse 3. What's wrong with this theological? Let's do a little theology. Well, this is simply factually incorrect, isn't it? Here's a Bible contradicts itself problem. He says, not with our fathers did Yahweh make this covenant. Wait a minute. Didn't he read Exodus? I mean, granted, this is Deuteronomy, right? We're a generation down the road. Deuteronomy is the second reiteration of what happened at Sinai. There are other differences between Deuteronomy 5 and Exodus 20. But what does he mean, not with our fathers? Did Yahweh make this covenant? Of course he made the covenant with their fathers, right? So what does he mean by this? Here's a classic textbook example of dialectic negation. Write that phrase down somewhere. Put it on, scribe it on the forefront or whatever you say, between your eyes, and let it be as a frontlet between your eyes. Dialectic negation. All right, it's a Hebrew idiom by which two things are contrasted as though they were negated. Not this, but that, when in fact, they're both. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Well, wait a minute. Didn't God command sacrifice? Hosea 6, right? Textbook example. Does he mean he doesn't want sacrifice? No. He wants sacrifice and mercy, but of the two, one of them at this point has a priority. If you have mercy and no sacrifice, it's better than having sacrifice and no mercy, because sacrifice without mercy is not real sacrifice. So he's putting these in attention. John baptized with water. I baptized, there one comes after me who baptizes you with the Holy Spirit and with fire. Does that mean he doesn't use water? Wow. That changes the way people have misused that passage. See? The scripture is full of this in the New Testament as well, dialectic negation. You can go read a little article on this in the Horace Hummel Festschrift. It's kind of, it's been a sort of a side interest of mine. I don't know what that, it's a Festschrift for Horace Hummel. Horace Hummel, you don't know, I don't think. Anyone ever heard? It sort of shows the passing of the time. Horace Hummel was the premier Old Testament prof when I was at the seminary, so I kind of learned Old Testament stuff at his feet. And he's retired now, he's still living in Southern California, but so we did a Festschrift for him. Something about the word of Yahweh. But he wrote that textbook, Word Becoming Flesh. I don't know if anybody still uses it. It's pretty opaque. But you ought to dabble in it someday. Okay. Well, what else can we say about this? Go on to verse 7. No, actually verse 6. Let's pick it up where we left off. And 5. You just hate, don't you hate it when the lectionary skips around? Not quite face to face. I was standing between Yahweh and between you. Remember how Hebrew uses bane twice? Between Yahweh and between you, between Yahweh and between you, ba'eth ha'hi at that time, lehagiz from Nagath to relate to you the Devar Yahweh. Ki yirethem, you were afraid from the panay, from the face of the fire, and not you went up on the mountain. Saying, thus, where does this go back? I guess this goes back to Yahweh the bear. Yahweh spoke with you, saying, verse 6, Anoki Yahweh Eloheka, I am Yahweh your God, Asherhot Satika, who brought you forth, Hifil of Yatzah, may Eretz Mitzrayim Abeth Avadim, from the land of Egypt, from a house of slaves. No article on Beth Avadim. Little review of construct chains. Why is it the land of Egypt? There's no article there, but two nouns in construct will always take the termination from the final noun. It's definite if it has a definite article, if it's a proper noun, or if it has a pronominal suffix, my word, as opposed to a word. But it's you never see this in English. They always say from the house of slavery. There's no article on Mabeth Avadim. That's just from a slave house. From a slave house. Question? Well, there are two phrases, Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Mabeth Avadim. So I think they're two different from a slave house. By the way, how many commandments are there? Well, there are 10. They're 10, yeah. They're never called the 10 commandments. They're called the 10 words. Right? What's the first one? I mean, the problem is that you can get about 13 out of Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. So the question is, which 10 are they? And if you grew up a Baptist, like my wife did, you realize that they get the 10 a different way than we get the 10. right? This whole business of the iconography business of "Thou shalt not make an image," which for Lutherans and Catholics and in the liturgical Catholic tradition are all part of the first commandment. But in the Jewish tradition, Gary, you would know this, the first commandment is verse 6. If you go in any synagogue, you'll see that up on top where they list the Ten Commandments, the first one, and the abbreviated by the first word, is anoki. This is the first word. Is it a law? Is this a commandment at all? No, it's a statement of fact. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of a slave house. Get it? We start with the gospel. This is what forms the people of God. And the whole point of Exodus and Sinai is he just saved them. Now we're organizing ourselves around the presence of God at mountain and in the cloud of his glory and in tabernacle and in land and in temple, organizing themselves. But the point of Sinai is, okay, I've just saved you. You're my people. Here's the way we're going to operate. Okay? That's the first word. I'm your God, you're my people, I've saved you. Now, you will have no other gods before me. Nice Hebrew idiom. Not will be to you God's other ones. There will not be to you other gods. You will not have other gods before me. Literally, it doesn't say before me, it says al panai, which is the only place in the Old Testament you get this odd expression. It doesn't simply mean before me, it says what? Al panai. Upon my face. Rather literally, or upon my presence, my turf, nobody else's turf. There's only one God. See, all the other religions had lots of gods, and so did the Canaanites. They had the gods of the world above. They had the gods of the world on earth. They had the gods of the underworld. They had the gods of the land and the sea and the hearth and the sun and the moon and the stars. And Yahweh comes along and says, "There's only one, and I made it all." Get it? You will have no other gods upon my face. And how would they respond to this? Like all your kids in junior confirmation, right? Oh, man, I can't have any fun now, right? All these commandments are here to ruin my life. Have you ever thought about when we teach kids the Ten Commandments? At precisely that point in their life when they're fighting everything in authority. And so the first thing we tell them is, here's 10 commandments. Look at all the bad ways in which you're breaking them. At Sinai, he says, you're my people. The alternative was slaves in Egypt. But I saved you from there. I brought you out from there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. You will have no other gods. What do you think their response was? Why would we? Of course not. You will not take my name in vain. What would they answer? Of course not. In fact, don't they say all that the Lord has spoken we will do? Of course, then what did they do? They screwed it up, right? Starting with the molten calf. Well, that's how third use of the law, which is what we really have here, Lutherans, that's how third use of the law ends up second use. Because in real life, lex semper accusat, right? You got to say it in Latin or it's not good theology. The law always accuses, all right? Which is why preaching third use of the law is so darn tricky, right? Because I can guarantee you most of the people will go home hearing it as second use. What we're supposed to do, and we're not shaping up. So law, gospel, law, good sermon outline, right? And then in the third part, you unload everything. You're not doing this. You're not giving enough money. You're not coming to my Bible classes. You're not making enough stewardship calls or evangelism calls. And everyone goes home feeling lousy instead of feeling pretty excited about being God's person and all that that entails. Hey, there's another little thing I'll point out, and then we'll spend the last few minutes on Deuteronomy 6. Well, not to mention the course syllabus. I never got to that, did I? Look at verse 8. Not you will make for yourself a pestle, an image, a statue, or any timunah, any likeness, which is in the heavens above, and which is in the earth below, and which is in the water from under to the earth. Nice Hebrew piling up of prepositions. This is a three-story universe, the heavens above, the earth below, and the underworld. Not you will bow down to them, tishtachwa, and not... Now here, I want you to parse this, because no English translation I know picks this up. Maybe there's one out there. And not to of dame. Parse to of dame. This is bonus points. Oh, you can make a good impression. To of dame. I'm even pronouncing it with O vowels to help you. It's from avaz. It's imperfect with a tau prefix and an object suffix. So you serve, will serve them. Except it's not kal, is it? Kal would have a pathak here. This is a kametz katuf followed by another kametz katuf, which means what's the conjugation? Somebody muttered it a minute ago. Hafal, right? Or hofal. You say hafal, I say hofal. Which means it should be translated how? The hafal is the passive of the hifil. So the hifil would not be served, but cause someone else to serve. So the hafal would be caused to serve. It's the causative that goes passive in the hafal. So this doesn't say you will not worship them, you will not serve them. It says you will not bow down to them, you will not be caused to serve them. Doesn't that put it in a different light? What was the problem in Egypt? They had trouble worshiping the god. In fact, they wanted a three-day pass to go worship the gods, the god of the Hebrews, their own god. And Pharaoh said, no, not in my territory. I'm God here. Now they're free from that, and they're so liberated that they can actually worship their god. It's not, do I have to go to church on Sunday? It's, we can actually not be caused to serve other gods, but we can worship the real God, the true God. See? You never see that unless you read it in Hebrew. Because I, Yahweh, your God, am an Elkanah, visiting the Awon of the fathers upon the sons, and unto the third generation, fourth generation, belonging to my hating ones, and doing chesed, to the thousandth. In parallelism, this is probably the thousandth generation, belonging to my loving ones and the keepers of my commandments. Okay, we did a little Deuteronomy 5. Cool. Before we go to Deuteronomy 6, let me finish the course syllabus. Here's how this is going to work. Bibliography. All right, you all got a BHS? I'm not telling you to go out and buy a William Holiday, but I still think it's the best hand lexicon. If you want the biggie, you got to buy Halot now. Because they got the Kaler Baumgartner completely translated. We'll talk about this some other day. I don't want to get too lost in this thing. How many of you have Holiday? How many of you have BDB? How many have something else? What do you got? Okay. Yeah, you get all these things. By the way, use your computer tools. Most of you have this stuff now. I'm not pretending they don't exist. But I shouldn't say that. For the purposes of this course, you almost should put them away. I think I'm going to recommend that. Here's what happens. You don't know enough to use them right yet. And the last thing you want is to be building a model of dependency on a crutch. You got to learn to walk. And there's no reason you can't be walking right now, if not running. So throw the crutches away and run. All right? The trouble with those computer tools, it's like an English translation. They serve a function, but it's kind of like where you go, either when you're really, really stuck and you have to get help, or when you want to check something. When you're done translating the text, then it's fun to open up several English Bibles and see, well, how did they handle this? Because I'm still not sure I figured this one out. See? Or this was a problem, and oh, that's what they did with it, but I don't think they got it right. See? All teachers tell, I don't want you to be able just to say, well, my computer told me this was a PL imperfect, second feminine singular. The question is, A, how do you know that? How do you know that? Not that the machine told you that. And secondly, what difference does it make? So what? Just knowing it's parsing doesn't tell you anything about why it makes a difference that it's a PL or something like that. What's going on here? That's what you have to discipline you, and that's what the tools don't do for you. They just give you information. See? So grind through the text. Figure it out yourself. I'm not saying you can't ever use the tools, but use them intelligently. And don't learn to use a crutch when you should be walking. We'll talk about the supplemental text. I don't know if you, some of you, who was here from, who told me you did this at Seward? Anybody here from Seward with Meal or something? That you guys were reading Waltke and O'Connor for bedtime reading? I mean, that's terrific. These guys are good. Waltke and O'Connor, right? All right. Quick, daily work will consist of translation and discussion of readings assigned according to the schedule indicated below. Students are to be prepared to analyze all forms, explain all grammar and syntax, and translate with minimal use of notes. This is why you can't just hook up in a computer and have it tell you what it is. In class, you should be able to tell what it is and why it is and what that doggish is actually all about. Okay? This is what you need to do. So translate with minimal use of notes. And you can't just be going, well, let's see here. That's I got it written down here. Okay? Here's my shtick. Three times, minimum. You have to translate each text three times. All right, to get it. The first time through is the first time through. You're hacking your way through the text, looking up every word you don't know, figuring out a verb form, trying to put the pieces together. That's what you do in preparation for Friday. Walk it into Friday with how many verses as we think we can cover, and we're going to try to shoot for about 5 to 10. We'll sort of see how this goes. It always goes slow at first. We'll get faster. Some of you are better than others. Some of you are struggling more than whatever, okay? But have about 5 to 10 verses prepared for Friday at that level so that you should be able to read out loud and analyze the forms and put together a rough translation, even if it's rough. Even if you say, once in a while, I just couldn't figure that one out, but I gave it my best shot. All right? That's what the first time through is. Then the Friday work session will try to pull all this together. Okay? Help you out, make sure everybody gets it. Then the second time through, you start gaining some speed. Right? And now all your questions are answered. And you can actually go, yeah, I know what this is. This is a PL, and it makes sense, and now I know what it is, and here's how the words connect, and oh, this actually makes a sentence, you see? And it says something, all right? That's what you're going to do between Friday and Tuesday. On Tuesday, we'll go through this very quickly, making some comments and observations and filling in the gaps in a plenary session. And here's the key that no student ever remembers to do. After that comes the big money. Now you translate it a third time. And now you're driving on your own. Nobody's in the back seat. Nobody's playing driver ed. Now you're driving the car all by yourself, all alone. You're taking this baby out on the track. Okay? And you actually realize that you can do this. And it's making sense. And you can sort of drop your finger down at any point in the text and know where you are. That's what you need to know to really be working with the language and get to that level, okay? And that only comes, I think, on the third time through. So pace yourself, set your goals, follow through. Friday class periods will focus on detailed translation. I just said all this. Tuesday class sessions will review translation, adding syntax, thought progression, interpretation. I get the fun stuff. Our fourth-year seminarians here, like Dale, will grind through the dirty work. Students will be prepared to spot check. All right, on Tuesday, I reserve the right to pick out a name from my little pack of cards and put anybody on the spot. Just to keep your little feet to the fire, this is not gospel. This is law. But it's in the service of the gospel. That's a good thing. Third use. So, what's this form? Parse it. Okay, you should be able to do that by the following Tuesday. All right. Now, I skipped at the very top of the page. We're also reviewing vocabulary. I don't know. Did anyone go out and buy this little Von Pelton practical thing? It's of all the... There's about 3 or 4 word lists. Hold that up once. I've lost mine in my office reshuffle. So can I borrow this for... I'm going to put this is obviously more than you need. We're going to do whatever it says there, the first 382 or whatever it is, words. Our words used 100 times or more. Those you should know ice cold, okay? Now the other lists, however, which is helpful in here, they also do a bunch of lists by a verbal root, which is the way to really learn Hebrew, where you get two and three for the price of one. You know how Hebrew works, right? It's all based on verbal roots. That's Semitic languages. That's how they work. They're all based on three-letter roots, except the words that only have two letters. But they're weak verbs, and they're missing something. So, and then they got by prepositions, they got by alphabet, they got different ways to slice and dice the word lists, which I just find helpful. It's kind of getting at it from different angles. So of all the word lists, this is probably the best one, and it's only $13.59 in the U.S. Now, if you don't want to buy that, and I never like to force students on limited budgets to buy books just to say they bought a book. If you're going to use it, use it. But I'll put one on reserve, and frankly, for the purposes of this course, you could actually just go Xerox the first whatever 182 words are. That's all you really need, okay? So I think it's worth buying, but suit yourself. Any questions? We're out of time, but I promised, because I've got this wonderful setup, I want to translate at least one verse of Deuteronomy 6. All right, so here we go. This is preview. This is now getting into the course. We're done with prolegomena. We're going to do something. V'zoth ha-mitzvah, you with me? This is working ahead now, but we're going to go through this on Friday then with you guys. V'zoth ha-mitzvah ha-kukim v'ha-mishpatim. Translate. This is the mitzvah, the statutes. The word was originally kolk. Is this very clear? Now this is looking blurry to me. I'll explain why kolk goes to kook some other day, okay? But you see how the vowel has shortened? Long O, the minute you add a suffix, then this syllable becomes closed and the vowel has to shorten. Closed vowel, short, I said that wrong. Closed syllable, short vowel. Good rule of thumb. And the mishpatim. So this is the commandment, the kukim, and the mishpatim, okay? What's wrong with this sentence? What's zoth? Which this is this? Masculine, feminine, singular, plural. Pick two. It's feminine, singular. Which of these nouns is feminine, singular? So the basic sentence, you see, is, this is the mitzvah. What do you do with the kukim and the mishpatim? See, when you're trying to put the sentence together. I don't know. This is where you kind of look up a commentary and see what they've done with this now. Is the real thing that he's talking about kind of a big concept? This is the mitzvah. And you see, we always tend to hear commandment as law. This is the mitzvah. Now, let's unpack mitzvah. It's the kukim and the mishpatim, asher tzvah Yahweh Elohim. I don't know. Which Yahweh Elohim tzvah, parse tzvah? If you're following along, you can read it a little more clearly in your own. This is PL or D, right? Perfect, third, singular, masculine. Why is there a comet's hay there? I thought comet's hay was the mark of a feminine, except in third haze. Remember, third haze, when the hay is there, always bring their own vowel to the dance. And it'll be different from the norm. But once you know what they bring to the ball, it's always the same. They'll always bring a comet's in the perfect, third, singular, masculine. In the imperfect, they'll always bring a segol. You know that? I mean, third haze are really quite controllable. Once you know what they do it every time. They're really, except for geminates, there's no such thing as an irregular verb in Hebrew. Do you understand this? All so-called irregular verbs are actually deviations from the norm for predictable reasons. Like a nun with a schwa is going to assimilate and become dagish forte. All right? Third haze disappear with vocalic suffixes. I mean, everything's predictable, except geminates. Don't hold me to Geminis. I can't figure them out either. All right, this is the commandment which Yahweh your God commanded. Lilameth, parse Lilameth. PL, infinitive construct, right? Lamath, to learn, and the PL to teach. To teach Ethkem. Lasoth, root is Asah, third hey. All third hays have infinitive construct ending in oath. You can take that to the bank. Well, once you know what third hays do, they do it every time. Infinitive constructs. Kal, Nifal, Hifil, everything. Third hay, infinitive construct ends in oath. This is Kal. So to teach you to do Ba'aretz in the land which you are overim, are crossing over, Shama. Why am I accenting the accent? See that little line there? That's the accent, right? What's the difference between Shama and Shama? Unaccented comets, hey. Unaccented comets, hey, is hey directive. So this is Sham plus hey directive, which means not there, but to there. Or if you like it, thither. All right, which you are crossing over to there, L'rishta. And I'll let the Headstrom figure that out for you on Friday. Because that's where the money is, L'rishta, we're done.